This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When Debbie Reynolds was 19, she starred in a movie that became iconic. When her daughter Carrie Fisher was 19, she too starred in a movie now permanently imprinted on American brains.
I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion into the memory systems of this R2 unit. My father will know how to retrieve it. You must see this droid safely delivered to him on Alderaan. This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
But not fully imprinted on her brain. There are parts that Carrie Fisher doesn't remember all that well. Not her best-selling novels, not parts of her marriage or the rehab. She opens her new book, Wishful Drinking, with the confession that she underwent a course of electroconvulsive therapy to treat her bipolar disorder, which has left some major holes in her memory of a remarkable life. Between the ECT, the drinking problem, the depression, the divorce, sounds like a laugh riot, right? Well, it is. Carrie Fisher joins us in just a moment. Later in the hour, all about the wiretap whistleblower. But first, if you'd like to talk with Carrie Fisher about her life, her work, or whether or not women can wear support garments in space, give us a call. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Carrie Fisher is Carrie Fisher. Her new book is called Wishful Drinking, and it's based on her one-woman show. She's with us from a member station in Pasadena, California, KPCC. It's great to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Hey, it's great to be on Talk of the Nation.
And I understand, I don't want to give away the ending to your book, but I understand that, that little speech we played, that is permanently imprinted on your brain.
It's permanently there, but I'm thinking of asking next time I have ECT for them to remove it.
Do you have a choice?
Like they'll give you a little. It would be. That's what I'm dreaming of. That you get a menu of things you can forget and remember, and you just tick off the things that you know.
It might become more popular if that was an option that was available.
I know. Well, I'm going to ask them to work on that.
You write in the book that ECT was something you approached very carefully. Your biggest experience of it was, of course, seeing Jack Nicholson in Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, well, it has a horrifying stigma attached to it. I mean, you know, you don't want to go into convulsions and bite down on a stick and have things on the...
No.
Undignified and scary. But it's not like that anymore. Now it's fantastic. It's like a vacation in the Bahamas that you forget.
Did they give you the stick to chew down on?
No stick.
No?
There's no stick. No, you go to sleep and you wake up with a headache and that's the end.
And you woke up feeling, well, there was a trade-off. You lost some parts of your memory, but you also felt a lot better.
I didn't lose anything that was that big of a deal. I figure you don't lose, like, the important things. You lose things, like if you met someone right before you had ECT, there'd be no way you'd remember that person. So it's important not to have, a new acquaintance drive you to the treatment because you won't know who they are.
Tell us about the voicemail message that's on your answering machine.
Well, my friend Garrett Eddington did this for me, and it says... What is it? It says, see, I can't remember. It says something like, this is Carrie Fisher's voicemail. Carrie Fisher has had ECT. So please leave your name, your number, and how you know Carrie, and maybe some anecdotes about your relationship. And if she remembers you, she'll call you back.
As you've noted throughout this book and throughout that one-woman show, all of this carries a lot of stigma, not just the ECT, but the alcoholism, the rehab, and all of that. You're not too shy about opening it up to us.
Well, shyness was never really a problem. If you grow up in a celebrity family... You can't really be that shy. But you know what the thing about telling it is, if I make it a secret, it has enormous power. You know, then I have to be scared that you're going to find it out about me. And I like if you find it out about me, I already got there first, so you're going to hear my version. But it actually is in this film Milk. The guy, someone actually sends him a death threat, and his friend wants him to put it in the drawer. And he puts it up on the refrigerator. So it's sort of like declaring it, you know, and then you own it. And then you have problems. Problems don't have you.
Yet, but does it create other problems? For example, you've got a daughter who's a teenager.
I know. Well, you know, it's not... She's been fantastic. It, you know, that's not easy for her. And that, which isn't fair because it's, you know, my problem, and I wish I could have sort of protected her from it completely. But she is a fantastic, fantastic girl, and she's got a great sense of humor. And, you know, when I said to her, she wanted to be a comic for a while. It's over now.
Good.
But I said, well, that's actually not a bad idea. I mean, if you do decide to do that, you have great material. Your father's gay. Your mother's manic depressive, your grandmother tap dances, and your grandfather shot speed. And my daughter laughed and laughed and laughed. And I said, baby, the fact that you know that's funny is going to save your whole life.
A lot of this stuff was painful to live through at the time, I would have to think. It's one thing to write about it in a sort of fictional way, and we all remember, even if you don't, Postcards from the Edge. It's another to play this out on stage and say, yes, this was me.
It's awesome to play it on stage. That is really, it's great because you get this sort of instant feedback from people. There's actually, you know, people that my audience is sort of alcoholics, sci-fi addicts, people that have bipolar disorder, gay people, and people now that have ADCT. So that's my cross-section. And I have people come on stage every night, and I put the Princess Leia wig on them, and I go into the audience. So it's great, you know, because, I mean, once you declare it, it sort of is less true.
It is also that I have to admit, I was reading this book in a bar last night. Fortunately, it's a place I'm known at because otherwise they would have thrown me out. This is laugh out loud funny.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know what I say? If my life wasn't funny, it would just be true. And that is unacceptable. You have to make the hard stuff funny as quickly as you can because otherwise it sort of just hangs over you.
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest, of course, is Carrie Fisher. Her book is called Wishful Drinking, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Vanessa. Vanessa with us from Martinez in California.
Hi, Ms. Fisher. I'm a huge fan of yours. I've always loved your writing. And I was curious how you transitioned from acting to writing and if it just came naturally or if you took any classes or how you learned your craft.
Well, I started writing really when I was pretty young because I started reading and books were like my first drug. You know, you get into books and there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I just fell in love with words, you know. I used to just underline the things I thought were so incredible. And I just, my dream was, well, if I could ever do that, you know. But then I got trapped in show business.
Can't imagine how that happened.
Well, it was an accident, though. It was only my second film, and it wasn't supposed to do what it did. Because, anyway, so I'd always wanted to write, and I did write for sort of therapeutic reasons. And so acting was the accident, really. But in my family, the trick would have been to stay out of show business, not to go in.
Yet you were going to, you were studying theater in London at the time.
My mommy made me go. She is so mean, my mother. It's terrible. No, but my mother did. My mother made me go. She is a very cruel taskmaster. But that actually was fun. That was some of the best time of my life. You know, it was totally unobserved. It was not Hollywood at all. It was just, you know, I was just one of these students. So that was great.
And it does explain that bit of an English accent.
The floating British accent. No, but you know what else explains that is this, try and say, I thought I recognized your foul stench when I arrived on board. And not have to say it a little arch. I mean, the dialogue, we used to say to him, you can type this stuff, but you can't say it.
Vanessa, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go now to Eric. Eric with us from South Lyon in Michigan.
Hi, Neil. I love your show. I listen to it every day when I come home from school.
Thank you.
Carrie, I'm just you know, I'm a big fan of the Star Wars movies. You know, I was raised on them as a kid, and I totally agree with, you know, laugh at everything. If you can't laugh at it, you know, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, you know, what were your thoughts when they presented you with the Danish head?
hairstyle in Star Wars, yes.
I actually got the part of Princess Leia with the stipulation that I lose 10 pounds. I have a tendency, if I gain weight, it goes directly to my face. I weighed 105 at the time, but I carried 60 of the pounds in my face. So I thought they'd still be mad at me if I didn't lose the weight. So I just didn't want to make any trouble. So they brought me they put the ridiculous hairstyle on me, and I just said, fantastic. Because, you know, I didn't want to be fired.
All right, thank you so much. I really appreciate your work.
Eric, thanks very much for the call. And fired, there was a long list of some pretty impressive actresses who were up for that part.
Yeah, well, they basically had a cattle call of everybody that was within sort of like 18 to 23. And it was cast, George was casting it at the same time that Brian De Palma was casting Carrie, the horror film.
Sure.
And in those days, George didn't talk. He's made up for that now. But he didn't talk at all. So he had Brian talk in the audition meeting. And then he would just watch.
And watch. Did he give you any indication that you'd gotten the part?
Not at all. And I was no way that I thought I was going to get the part. Because the last line in the script said, Princess Leia stands at the end of a long hallway, and she is staggeringly beautiful. And I crossed off the L-Y in beautiful and felt more comfortable about my description.
Our guest is Carrie Fisher. Her book is Wishful Drinking. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Carrie Fisher writes in the introduction to her memoir, I am truly a product of Hollywood. You might say that I'm a product of Hollywood in breeding. When two celebrities mate, something like me is the result. The book, Wishful Drinking, is based on her one-woman stage show. If you'd like to talk with her about her life and her work, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation underway at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And Carrie Fisher, in the last segment, you said you were talking about how your mother was such a terrible taskmaster. We should point out, your mother is also your next-door neighbor.
My mother, I'm kidding. My mother isn't a taskmaster. She actually wanted me to go to drama college in England because it would bring respectability to the family. You know, like we were a bunch of hookers, and drama college was the only way to eradicate it.
A step up
like
in the
that.
World, yeah.
Right. But I ended up, you know, she was right. I ended up enjoying it. And, you know, and now I've turned into my mother. She's a performer, and I didn't want to perform for many, many years. I had stage fright. But I did nightclub work with her, like most teenagers.
Absolutely,
nightclub work from when I was 13 to 17, throwing mic cords in Vegas.
But you were part of the act.
Mm-hmm. It's a way our family, the way our family has like a family outing, most families go on picnics. We go on stage. We go to Vegas. My brother was in the act as well.
What did he do?
He played the guitar.
And you? You were a singer?
I sang in an orange shirt with white sequins and bell-bottom pants.
Well,
nice.
We all have embarrassments in our past. It's a good thing there's no pictures of people on the radio, because otherwise I couldn't live it down myself.
Hey, this is the best spot. I look the best on this program. I have gotten such... I've looked... this is a mistake, but someone's actually sent me some of the blogs online.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, there's a big discussion about how fat I am, which I sort of wanted to join in at a certain point. But anyway, some people are defending me, and some people are saying that I look like Jabba the Hutt.
I somehow doubt that.
Well.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. Let's go to, this is Jonathan. Jonathan with us from Phoenix.
Hi, Carrie. I wanted to just touch base on something. My brother went to rehab in 1990 or 91, and he is in Hollywood, and his story is that you actually drove him to the Betty Ford Center when he was down and out.
Physically, or she was the cause of it?
No, that she was the one who picked him up and put him in the car and took him to Betty Ford Center. And my question is, his name is Matthew, and he's a projectionist in Hollywood, and I'm just curious to know if you remember that, if it's a
true story. Well, again, you're talking to someone who's at ECT, so it's entirely possible that it did happen, but that I don't recall it. But I don't remember really going to Betty Ford. My father was in Betty Ford. Maybe he drove your brother. Or maybe I did. I mean, you know, or just to a meeting.
Well, the story was that he was at a star's house doing a projection for a movie.
Oh, wait! Wait a minute! Your brother, I swear to you that, okay, yes, we were in David Geffen's house, and he had a flat-out anxiety attack. Is this your brother? And I was pregnant, and I drove him to the hospital.
Yes. I just wanted to say thanks.
Not to Betty Ford, though.
Okay.
Well, you're welcome. I walked in the hospital with your brother, and they thought I was coming in to have my baby.
Well, he actually ended up going straight to rehab and has done remarkably well with his sobriety. So I'd like
to good. Tell him hello. So he's about 16 years sober then.
Roughly.
That's when I was pregnant with Billy.
Well,
I'm glad to hear that worked out.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you directly that Princess Leia saved my brother. I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's good.
Thanks for the call, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Now, Jonathan's brother, you also got drug counseling at one point from Cary Grant, of all people.
Well, yes. My mother found out that I was taking LSD, and she was concerned, as any mother would be. And
sure,
so
yes.
She did what any mother would do. She called Cary Grant. But Cary Grant had, you know, he had a reputation of having experimented with acid with his doctor, under doctor supervision, which always sort of, I could never figure that out. Like, did the doctor do the acid? Did he do it in his office? Did they do it in the hospital? Did they wander around? But unfortunately, I didn't get to ask him that. But we had a long couple conversations on the subject because my father also told him that I had an acid addiction.
How did he begin the conversation? Carrie, it's Carrie?
Hi, well, yeah, I guess. And at the time, I was 24. I was making one of the worst films ever made, Under the Rainbow. Rush out right now and see it, if you can. And anyway, so I was working with Chevy Chase. And Chevy had just said on some show that Cary Grant was bisexual. So Cary Grant was suing him. And I wasn't getting along that well with Chevy either. So we initially started the conversation by saying how, you know, what we had in common other than the acid was that neither of us got along with Chevy.
Well, that's a good basis for a relationship right there. Let's see if we can get Jerry on the line. Jerry is with us from O'Fallon in Missouri.
I am not, I must confess, not a fan of Star Wars, but you were in two of the funniest film scenes I think I've ever seen, the confrontation with Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi in the tunnel in the Blues Brothers, and of course he is the leader of the group therapy session in
Austin Powers.
But hearing you reminds me of Oscar Levant, who wrote very candidly, but also was very funny about his mental illness, and I guess it's...
Right, it's, he was what, he was bipolar, right?
Yes.
Oh, and of course, he almost made like a second career on the Jack Parr show with his, you know, that in some ways, it was, you know, you'd bring him out and you'd think, oh, this is the guy who used to be the biggest concert draw in the 1940s and an excellent pianist. But I find that's an interesting, to look at it with humor and yet quite bluntly is I think a very good approach to take, but one that seems to be kind of unique. And
well, you know, I think it's hard because it does have the stigma. And I mean, like my mother, I was on some show and I had said, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm mentally ill. And my mother said, darling, you're not mentally ill. You're manic depressive. So, I mean, maybe that doesn't sound as bad to her. But I think actually there, you know, if you're manic depressive and you're functioning in this world and doing it all well, I think, wow, you should be proud of being able to say, this is what I'm getting through right now. You know, there should be, it's like when you end up in a mental hospital with all these people, you're like, it's war stories. And by the way, it's the only place you can say, you know what I mean? And everyone will say, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just think that's an excellent way to deal with it. Like you say, when you bring it up first, it no longer has the stigma. You've kind of
Right. Well, so no one can sort of, you know, pull the rug out from under you and say, you know, are you mentally ill? You know, but I'm proud of it. I mean, I'm proud that I made it through some of these things. It's tough stuff, you know, well, and to make it through and be able to tie your shoelaces and chew gum is, you know, sometimes difficult thing.
And of course, concerning your daughter, all of us know that if you have teenagers, no matter what your diagnosed state is, they always think that you have a mental illness. So,
and I think adolescence is a form. Well, it is my job to embarrass my daughter. Part of my job. And at this age, do you have teenagers?
Yes, two.
Oh my!
On into the 20s. So,
God. Well, that must be a relief.
But sort of.
Yeah, no, she's furious with me. And I loathed my mother as a teenager.
Well,
so there.
I think we all get what we probably dished out. So you know.
Absolutely. I think if it is my job. Otherwise, I would just feel bad about it.
Well, I look forward to reading the book, and I've enjoyed hearing your interview on Diane Rehm and also on this show.
Jerry, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Just following up on that, a lot of people would wonder, yes, of course, it's really hard to get through this stuff and come out the other side, but you were a high-functioning bipolar person. You did a lot of things.
I did a lot of things, and between doing them, I didn't do anything. I mean, it was hard. It's manic depressive, so it comes and goes. When you're manic, you can get quite a bit accomplished until it goes off the rails. But yeah, I mean, I think it's part of what made me creative. You know,
really?
It's sort of it's liquid confidence, you know, and there's nothing better than feeling like you can do anything. I mean, that's confidence is half the battle. And so mania is great. The other, you know, one mood is the meal. The next mood is the check. And so if you've seen me functioning in the world, that's the meal. The stuff you don't see is the check.
Let's get Mary on the line. Mary's with us from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Hi. Oh, I'm falling more in love with you as I listen.
I'm assuming you're talking about her and not me.
Well, I love your show, Neil, but the book I devoured, and I don't do Star Wars, so I didn't know you as Princess Leia. What I particularly like and what you might be able to comment on, because I feel like I have this in common with you with my sort of dysfunctional family, is your ability to so lovingly and compassionately and humorously skewer your parents a bit. And it seems healthy.
Well, I love my parents. What?
Particularly with your father.
My father. My father, who I call Puff Daddy, because he smokes four joints a day. What I didn't say was that my father, on the opening of my show, brought his dealer, which was nice. But I showed anybody that's in the book, I showed them, you know, I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. So my parents know what's in it, and they, you know, they read the book, they came to the show, they both came on stage.
Well, fantastic. I'd love to see the show.
Well, thank you. And everyone has a dysfunctional family, so, I mean, if they don't, I don't understand. Yeah, there's more to talk about.
Yes, exactly. Stories.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Mary.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Are you still doing the show?
Yeah. I mean, let's see. I've done it all year, all over the place, and that's how I gained the weight. And now we're going to do it in Seattle in March. But we, you know, we're still working out what to do with Broadway. You know, the producer is a genius in his own right. But I digress.
We're talking with Carrie Fisher about her book and her one-woman show. Both have the same name. It's Wishful Drinking, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And this email from Tom in Lansing, Michigan. I'm a big fan of the notorious Star Wars Christmas special. I was wondering if Carrie could comment on the TV special.
How could you be a fan of that and not need psychiatric care? It is one of the worst. And the thing about it is if things are bad, sometimes you can enjoy bad things. This is so bad, you can't enjoy it. But I have a copy. It was one of the... I did the voiceover for the Star Wars, you know, DVD, whatever. And the stipulation was that George give me a copy of the Star Wars Christmas special so we could laugh at it at my house. And it gets, I mean, it's Art Carney is in it. It is the weirdest thing. The woman who played on, I can't remember. But it just awful. There's Live Wookiee Day, and I don't really remember. I sing in it. We celebrate our day of peace. It is, and we're all in it. I think George never thought the film would be a big hit, so he made a deal to do a special before it came out.
Let's get Carl on the line. Carl with us from Anniston, Alabama.
Hi, Carrie. I'm wondering if you still... attend AA if your celebrity interferes with your recovery at all.
No, it doesn't interfere. I do. I am. But you know, we're supposed to maintain anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film.
Love of tradition.
Right. Yes, no, I've been in AA since I was 28, but I have not stayed sober the entire time. And that's my fault. That has nothing to do with the effectiveness of 12-step stuff, because I think that's the only real way that you can get sober. So, yes, I'm around it. Am I celebrity getting in the way of it? The bad thing is if you think you're special, you know. So I've worked very hard on not thinking I'm special, because then I think I'm too good, you know, for just a regular person's, you know, recovery. But I'm not too good for it, so there you have it.
Carl, thanks very much. And let's see if we get one last caller in, and this is Chris. Chris with us from St. Augustine, Florida.
Hi, Carrie. I'm a big fan. I was just curious if your mom and Elizabeth Taylor still talk, and if, in fact, you talk to Elizabeth Taylor, if maybe there's no communication there.
No.
Just do a little backing and filling here.
Oh, right. My father and mother, it's sort of like Brad and Jennifer. My mother and father were the Brad and Jennifer of their generation, which is in the 50s. And then my mother, Jennifer Aniston, got left by my father, Brad Pitt, if only, for Angelina Jolie or Elizabeth Taylor. So Elizabeth is the Angelina. And I actually wrote a TV movie with a friend of mine, Elaine Pope, and on the show was my mother, Elizabeth, Shirley MacLaine, Joan Collins, and I can't remember. But anyway, yes, they talked, and I actually am in more touch maybe than she is, but I actually gave an award to her, and what I said in the... in the introduction was, I thanked her for helping to get Eddie Fisher out of our house.
He wasn't in her house all that long either.
Right. But we're really good friends with her grandsons, whom my daughter had a crush on one of her grandsons. Anyway, they're both adorable. And they asked me if they were related in any way, and I told them that they were related by scandal.
Chris, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Carrie Fisher, you've been a delight. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Carrie Fisher's book, Wishful Drinking. She joined us today from the studios of our member station in Pasadena, California, KPCC. Coming up, Michael Isikoff of Newsweek magazine on the man who blew the whistle on the Bush administration's illegal wiretaps and could face jail time for his trouble. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.